accession number 19906, Reel 2.
Wally Blanchard, Reel 2.
In our case, the class, instead of taking 8 weeks to train, had to take 7 weeks. Because of the shortage of manpower due to the loss of ships and personnel. Before you left Ganges, the training at Wych was extremely harsh. I would say harsh but fair. They expected us to do all of the things that an embryo seaman would do. We had to learn all about boat work, sailing, rowing, and knots and splices. At the Ganges, it was noted that the mainmast of the original sailing warship Ganmast was Ganges, was installed on the parade ground. It was more than 127 feet high, the most part of which was climbable. You had to be able to do this as part of your training. And most of the knot work and learning to splice was carried out on the first yardarm, where you sort of had to cling on with your feet and your instructor balanced along the front of you. You learnt the rudiments on the ground, of course, but you went aloft to practice them, which is the way of the Navy. Whatever you do in the Navy, as soon as you are taught it, you have to start to practice it. I do not believe in any stale period in between. So that, towards the end of the 7 weeks, we also had to pass two swimming tests. A lot of other naval establishments didn't do this. This is why a lot of people drowned at sea, because they couldn't swim anyway. But there you are, that was warfare. But at the Ganges, you couldn't even get your weekend pass, which was all important, to get home before you got drafted to a warship. So you had to pass one or both swimming tests before you could go home. I managed to do this with the help of some very able shipmates. They concocted some sort of stroke whereby I could get up and down the bath. The hardest one was 2 widths of the bath dressed. By dressed, the Navy put you into a heavy white canvas duck suit, which was dry when you jumped in, but soaking wet before you got halfway across, and it weighed a ton, and you had to learn to turn over and get back to the other side. Now this is important, we learned, as I did later on in my naval service, having to abandon ship, what it is to have your clothes on in the water. Eventually, got home on leave for a few days. I then had to report to HMS Pembroke at Chatham. I was not prepared for what I was going to find at Chatham, even though our old gunnery instructor at HMS Ganges had exhorted us to get out of Chatham barracks as soon as possible. The barracks were designed to hold about 3,000, reasonably. At the time I was there, it was holding between 13 and 14,000 in various states of either coming to the barracks, leaving it, joining ships, or otherwise. There were, indeed, other people hiding in the barracks, because not everybody is imbued with the idea of going to war. Some people were actually hiding away from the law in the barracks and making a criminal living. All of this was sorted out by the barracks police and guards eventually.
What kind of criminal living?
Thieving. Thieving either naval property and stores or off all of us recruits coming through who didn't know anything about things at all. However, I remembered what I'd been told at the Ganges, and I duly booked a course, which means you start to specialise in the service. The course that I booked was denoted on the course board as AA3, LC in brackets. Now, the lad who I'd spoken about earlier, having been instrumental in his rescue back home in Devon Road, was by now a coxswain of a landing craft in the Navy. And he had asked, he'd suggested to me that I requested combine operations to try and get with him, which we probably could have done. You could ask for each other. So when I put my head through the little door in the drafting office, I was bellowed at by a drafting chief petty officer, "What do you want?" And I told him, and I asked him what that LC meant. "Does it mean landing craft?" "Yes, of course it does," he said. And he bundled me off, put my name on the list. But by the next morning, I was piped for. That is a term in the Navy where your name comes over the tannoy and you have to report somewhere or do something. It's very important that you hear all the pipes, if they may pertain to you. I duly reported down there, and they told me to get my kit together, bag, hammock, and all the paraphernalia that sailors have to carry, and muster at the drill shed. And I was detailed off and got into a lorry. The lorry conveyed us to Sheerness Dockyard. And there, alongside, were two destroyers, one of which had, in fact, both of which had already sustained battle damage, and one of which was ready for sea. And she was HMS Maynell.
HMS what?
Maynell.
How do you spell it?
A Hunt-class destroyer. Meynell. And we were on about 12-hour steaming notice. It was at this time, apart from going aboard merchant ships with my uncle and the odd Navy day before the war, I had never really seen a warship or yet got aboard one. From the moment that we stepped aboard the Maynell, we started to learn about the Navy and everything you had to do. We steamed north, up the North Sea. We weren't told where we were going, but the civilian dockyard personnel had already told us we were going to Reykjavik, which was the main base for the convoy terminals for Murmansk.
About which month is this?
This is... it's towards the autumn of 1942.
That's good enough.
I think I'm correct in that. Yeah, it's a little bit difficult. Must have been about that time. I'll tell you why in a minute. So all the way up the North Sea, in company with other ships, we're busy exercising the armament, firing off a great deal of ammunition, learning to drop depth charges, and wasting an awful lot of fuel, I presume, in doing it. So by the time we eventually got to Iceland, having been sick most of the way and living on corned beef sandwiches and what have you, we had to go alongside the boys at in Reykjavik Harbour. The first thing we did was turn to clean the ship, re-ammunition the ship, refuel her and restore. Again, 12-hour steaming notice to escort a convoy, presumably going up to North Russia. Before that could happen, we had to put to sea because there was a convoy under attack coming back, and they had attacked the escorts. By this time, the Germans were getting wise. They realised that if you attack the escorts with that short range to from there to the Norwegian coast, the merchant ships would be easy pickings. There were also U-boats operating in the vicinity, and the threat ever-present of surface warships coming out, because you do get patches and periods of mist and fog and that sort of thing. We learned of the presence of the convoy by dint of the noise of battle, because they were being attacked all the way down. We joined action, and it was a running fight, I suppose, over the next 48 hours, roughly, to get us back to Reykjavik. The ship I was in wasn't actually hit, but a stick of bombs dropped to either side of the ship, and being a destroyer, they are like paper compared to heavier warships, so she began to leak rather badly down below. Nothing much was put out of action. There was some blast damage to personnel, the crew would say, and aside from that, we managed to escape from it all. We went back into Reykjavik, carried out some repairs, again restored, reprovisioned, ammunitioned and fueled, and the damaged escorts and the damaged merchant ships were detached to Liverpool.
What was your job during the action?
I was on the 4-inch anti-aircraft guns. And each time, this may be a rather humorous, especially to people who have done it or have been there, we were unaccustomed to Navy rum. But because we managed to secure hits on several targets, they spliced the main brace. Well, all of the older members of the crew knew very well what that meant. They had a tot of rum. And all of us, whether underage or not, we all got it. So what with corned beef, rum, and being ill, and learning the business of sailoring and fighting if you're at the rough end, we didn't come through too badly. Great feeling of a relief, I think, at the end of that bit.
What had you personally seen during the action?
Action is always, I learned that from the beginning, that action is always confused. There's a great deal of smoke and noise takes place. I have in my possession photographs taken in Portland Harbour by a member of an RAF crash boat. And the photographs portray a Stuka attack on a British flak ship. She was a merchant ship converted into an anti-aircraft cruiser. A particular friend of mine, a shipmate we call each other in the Royal Naval Association, was aboard her that day. She came under very heavy attack. She bore the brunt of the attack by about 35 Stukas. Most of the time, they couldn't see the targets because of the amount of smoke and fire that was about them. The ship was hit several times until she was finally sunk. His own close friend, the captain of a four-barreled pom-pom gun, was badly hit. He was fatally hit. His legs were shot to pieces, but he would not desert his post. He was a leading seaman. They got him off the ship eventually, but he died. He was awarded a posthumous VC. As far as I know, the only one that was issued in British waters. The name of the ship was HMS Foyle Bank, and she is commemorated to this day in Portland. But that sums up action. You start out with things quite clear in front of you. The noise and the confusion and the amount of smoke that seems to be generated, and battle itself has a peculiar smell about it. We used to call it stunk. I think it's a combination of many words, probably stink and things like that, you know. People may have heard of it before, but we have used that term.
And stunk was a smell?
Yes, all things. It sums up everything, all the peculiar odours of cordite, enemy explosives, and various noises and sounds around you. And fear. Plain and simple. I think after a while, in the matter of fear, you get tired of being afraid for some reason, and you just do things as you should do them, the way you've been trying to do them.
But during the action, what were you actually doing on the gun?
I was at first serving the gun, that is to say, conveying the ammunition to the breeches, and then you drop it into the loading trays, and the gun layers close the tray and fire the guns. Everyone has their job around a gun, in other words. But you have ammunition or loading numbers. Eventually move round and relieved each other. The basic training for that was carried out at the Ganges and in the gunnery school. So we knew how to serve guns manually. And we also knew how to load and fire them and train and elevate them.
So you were telling me about what happened after that action, please.
Yes, the damaged warships were used to escort equally damaged merchant ships, some of which were still, and also some other vessels with cargo, which we picked up on the way. And the idea was to take them into Liverpool Bay for discharging. And Liverpool was also a repair base. Liverpool was under air attack, so they deemed it wisest not to go in there. It was complicated by a rumour that the dockers in Liverpool were refusing to handle certain cargoes. This may or may not be, and it did happen from time to time. There were dangerous cargoes. After all, they were basically civilians. We all know that the country was at war, but you couldn't compel civilians normally to do what servicemen would do. This caused some sort of annoyance amongst Liverpool-born crew members, who threatened all sorts of things. So we were diverted to Belfast Lough.
What were they threatening?
Oh, well, you know what they are. They were relatives, and their relatives would be dock workers. So I leave it to your imagination as to what they would do if they met up with them. But there may just have been a rumour. These things did circulate if you couldn't get into a particular port. Liverpool was burning anyway. It was quite clear they'd been under heavier attack during the night.
But were they threatening to assault their own relatives?
It's possible. Liverpudlians be what Liverpudlians are, very much a law unto themselves. I have happy recollections of Liverpool shipmates as well as any others, Glaswegian to anyone else, because you have to live, sleep and fight together. And you can't fight each other if you're going to do that. But we went into Belfast Lough and effected more repairs. A signal came through from Admiralty, apparently, for all of us to proceed to Plymouth, or Devonport in this case. And the merchant ships would be detached to Falmouth. Falmouth was a repair base in those days, mostly for Western Approaches, convoys and people like that. Now, once having got into Devonport, we stayed with the ship for a while until the dockyard were ready to receive her. Got her into the dockyard and the ship's company were taken off, except for those who would be on care and maintenance aboard her. And a number of us were due to go on courses, which I had booked before I left Chatham, HMS Pembroke. And the course I had asked for was on the board, so to speak, in the drill shed. And I was detailed to go down and do this course, which was in anti-aircraft gunnery, AA3, third class anti-aircraft gunner. It was not my intention to do that because I had asked for landing craft. I did protest, but the Navy being the Navy, I was told in no short order to shut up and get on with it, which is what I did. I went down and did this course. The second part of the course entailed going up to HMS St Christopher, which is in Fort William in Scotland in those days. Now, in doing that, you would board motor torpedo boats and a flotilla of other craft that were laying up there, specifically as for training purposes. You would learn torpedo firing, and again, depth charging, and close-range anti-aircraft work, all of which we did. we encountered elements of 41 Royal Marine Commando while we were up there. Did I but know it, that was to be my destination. Not 41, but 42 Royal Marine Commando, eventually. And we did exercises with them while we were up on the lock. We also were attacked one day by a German sweep. I think they were Dornier 17s or something like that. They used to sweep across from the North Sea, obviously trying to find naval anchorages working up towards Scapa Flow. Most of the heavy warships were dispersed from time to time in the locks up there, much in the fashion that the Germans did with their heavy ships in the Norwegian fields. It was deemed safer than leaving them in Scapa Flow after the sinking of the Royal Oak, of course. And once again, we did quite well. Because some of us had been in action before, we were able to hit, I think, if I'm right in saying, two of the Dorniers, and they decided to go away. They left us alone after that. There are a lot of humorous things that happen while all this is going on. It's not all stern action stuff. What actually happens is that people make jokes at other people's expenses and whatnot. And the instructors aboard one of the craft, I'd just boarded her from another craft because she had twin Oerlikon 20mm cannon mountings on her. Well, every so often it's customary to change the barrels because of the wear and tear on the gun barrels, as well as changing the magazines. Now, the Oerlikon is one of those guns that you can depress the barrel and you give it a turn or two in either direction and it unlocks and you're able to take the barrel off and refit it with a replacement barrel. Well, this particular crew, they'd hurried round and done just this, and there was a German scouting aircraft in the vicinity which decided to take a look at them. So they ordered open fire and the right-hand barrel, which had just been changed, promptly flew off. Off the gun mounting altogether and went over the side, much to the amusement of other people, but not to the gunnery instructors or the captain of the particular vessel. While all that was going on, the magazines had to be wound up with a sort of clockwork spring. You wound the rounds into the magazine with it, and that gave you the tension, and as the gun was firing, the spring would push each new round down, because the Oerlikon gun fires with what's known as an open breech. Most guns fire with a closed breech. The Oerlikon was technically open, as the discharge round cartridge was ejected, the new round would be entered and closed, and nothing would happen until the breech finally closed and fired the round. Once again, the breech would then be open, so you got a certain amount of emission from the rear of the mounting. And, somebody had, in mounting the magazine, hadn't got it secured properly. And the first round exploded, and so did the rest of the magazine, which opened out like an old-fashioned accordion, with all the Oerlikon shells flying about in all directions. So you see, nobody was hurt, fortunately, from all of this. It's best to do all that sort of thing in training rather than have it happen to you in action. Well, I don't doubt that it did happen in action, but I didn't witness it again. Now, when I finished there, we were sent back to the Coastal Forces main depot, which was at Gosport, HMS Hornet. From there, you are deployed to various bases around the coast, or were in those days. I was to go to Dover. I did a couple of what you might call stints or rapid drafts while I was at Hornet, when they were short of crew for a particular night on an MTB or a motor gunboat or a launch, any of those. It wouldn't mean that I was permanent crew. Within a day or two, the chap who was on leave or something like that would be back and I'd come back ashore. But my draft eventually was to go to Dover, which I did. And at Dover, the base there was called HMS Wasp. It was sited, or the barrack accommodation is in the Lord Warden Hotel, which is still there to this day, on just at the base of the pier arm at Dover, the West Pier. Now, to get there, you have to go by train, and it emerges from a tunnel under Shakespeare Cliff, along St Margaret's Bay, I think it is, into Dover Priory Station. Now, the Germans at that time had clear sight of Dover, as we did of Calais, and fire would be exchanged across the channel with long-range guns. Now, if they should sight the train's smoke or steam coming out of the tunnel, they would immediately range on it, and they had the whole coast, all of that part of the coast, zeroed in. They knew exactly where to drop their shells. They were fairly accurate, but distance and being what it is, and the curvature, the trajectories weren't always as accurate as they might have been. But on this particular occasion, during the course of the draft, we arrived in London because due to bombing, trains were being diverted. And the train I was in, we went into Charing Cross. She was backed into Charing Cross Station. Well, since a lot of us lived within reaching distance of Charing Cross Station, and I hadn't been home for a while, I decided to nip home. But to do that, I had to take... You weren't allowed to leave your rifle behind anywhere. Most people in those days carried their rifles, including sailors, if you were in that particular part of the service, you know. So I had that with me, and I had... a respirator and a steel helmet, all of which you had to carry. But the rest of it I could dump on the platform and it would be put into the guard's van on the train. Now, we hurtled off, the various of us that lived fairly close, and I considered that I lived pretty close to Charing Cross Station, living in Barking, and nothing was wrong with the underground, so I did it. I was indoors for precisely about 20 minutes, just in time to see my father. And he was amused because I was wearing battle dress at the time. It struck him as funny that sailors should be wearing battle dress, but that was what we were dressed in at the time. And I eventually rushed back up there, only to see the train going out. Well, you're immediately in trouble. You've missed a draft. Fortunately, the army were in charge of transport arrangements. The RTO sergeant said, "You lads are adrift. You've got to catch that train, get on that lorry." And at that time, the army was running circuit lorries all around London. And we caught the train again at London Bridge. They backed into London Bridge and they picked up. They must have known, with about 100 or more people still to get on the train. I still had to run to get on the train. What I didn't know was I'd left my steel helmet at home indoors. So I boarded the train with everything except that. At the other end, when we emerged from Shakespeare Cliff, unfortunately the train decided to belch a bit of steam and smoke for some reason, as steam engines sometimes do. And we ran into the station to be told to get off the train.